Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the Kenyan activist Boniface Mwangi has been telling me about his latest arrest, and he says tactics to silence critics of the government are from a bygone era.
And it's a very sad thing because Kenya was like that in the 80s. So we're going back to the same era because at the moment you can't call for a peaceful protest. And if you call for a peaceful protest, you get arrested, people get tear gassed, people get shot at. It's just bad, bad, bad.
Also, we'll be hearing why the indigenous people of Biafra want to separate from the rest of Nigeria and why successive governments have resisted that call. It's Friday, the 1st of November. First, we go to Botswana. We've been discussing the country quite a lot these last few weeks, and we've been pointing out how much of an outlier it is in African politics and economics. We're talking about that once again, because Botswana, that is, the people of Botswana, have done something that citizens up and down the continent have struggled to do. They have sent the governing Botswana Democratic Party, their ruling party, packing. And here's another thing that happened.
I wish to congratulate the opposition on their victories and concede the elections. I am proud of our democratic processes and I respect the will of the people. I will respectfully step aside and I will participate in a smooth transition process ahead of inauguration. I'd like to thank the BDP and its supporters and encourage them all to accept the democratic results and the will of the people.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi conceded defeat without threats of violence or court cases. So unlike what's happening in neighboring Mozambique, or what people in the United States fear could happen in their country after elections next week. His party, the BDP, had been in power for 58 years, now out of power for the first time since independence in 1966. As of Friday morning, the umbrella for democratic change under Duma Noko seems set for victory. We'll get to know him better and hear what the UDC offers. But where did the outgoing BDP go wrong? Let's hear how soon-to-be ex-president Mokgweetsi Masisi explains their catastrophic loss at a press conference.
We got it wrong big time in the eyes of the people. Clearly, we were convinced to get it right. We were really convinced about our message. We stand by our principles and our manifesto, and we put out a very pragmatic, a plausible, a deliverable manifesto. And so I really don't want to speculate too deeply about where we might have gotten it wrong. I'm saying you will sit down and reflect.
Innocent Silahlwa was at that press conference in the capital, Gaborone. It's not often that African presidents concede defeat, and it's not often that they concede defeat even before all the votes have been counted. Botswana, as we've been pointing out here on Focus on Africa for the last few weeks now, is kind of an outlier in very many regards. Did he expect to lose?
Actually, from the clip itself, he does say that he thought he had done everything right. And, you know, even their campaigning, how they were doing it, people were always their pegs. He actually did not see it coming, especially as bad as it is.
So he thinks they did everything right. The electorate clearly disagrees with them. Why did they lose, do you think?
Well, I think it has always been coming. If I take you a little back, after the BDP won 2019 elections, the opposition would then win council elections. There were about 16 re-elections for, you know, members of the council, which is lower than the parliamentary seats. And all of those were won by the opposition because people had shortly after Masisi took over started complaining that, you know, it was just like the old same BDP and they were not seeing any differences. They felt like he was corrupt. He was doing, you know, favors for his family and hiring people just close to him. Unemployment going high. And just recently, he even wanted to introduce pensions for former vice presidents and their wives and children. So those are some of the things that got people really mad. And also, I think, you know, the BDP started campaigning really late. You know, they took a lot of time to have their primary elections where they would select people who would no contest for them. And also on the side of the opposition, they have learned in terms of packaging their messages. For example, in the 2019 presidential debate, a lot of people fought the incoming president, Duma Boko, of, you know, because of some of the things they said, they felt that he was not using the right words. And this time around, during the presidential debate, he was very calm, you know, respectful.
They seem to be the incoming party. What do they offer?
They are offering, for example, 300,000 jobs, you know, because unemployment is high. They are offering better health services. People have been complaining that our health services are really poor. They are offering better living wage for the elderly, the pensioners. They've been earning what is quite small. Now they are offering almost more than double what they've been earning. They're also offering the minimum wage, which is more than double what people have been earning. And also corruption. There was a lot of corruption talk about, you know, former President Mokgweetsi Masisi. There were a lot of accusations. You know, the UDC during their campaign, they amplified all this. They reached all the corners. And where they were not there, the BPF was there. And, you know, with Khama, he attracted a lot of people and they would listen to him. Even when he says, if you don't vote for the BPF, at least vote out Masisi.
And I'm intrigued by the beef between Ian Khama and Mokgweetsi Masisi. What was it? Because it was quite powerful.
Yes, his message, you know, was consistent. It was short to say, I made a grave mistake by putting this man here. And that was just adding on to all the other issues that also the other parties were complaining about.
So let's talk about the lawyer, the human rights lawyer, Duma Boko, who is likely to be the next president of Botswana. Who is he?
When he took over as the president of the Botswana National Front, through which he became the president of the Umbrella for Democratic Change, there were a lot of fights within the party. Some even left the party. Some of them felt like this guy didn't even have membership. He has not been voting. They were accusing him of that. And now he just wants to come and be our president. So there was a lot of resistance. But as a lawyer, Boko stood his ground and he won the cases even at court. He started working with other opposition leaders to say, okay, let's unite, because his party, Botswana National Front, has always been, you know, about uniting opposition parties. And eventually they ended up doing it. Approaching the elections, he made it clear to say, I'm not going to be standing for a parliamentary seat, which is uncommon in Botswana. Usually opposition leaders would also contest for parliament in case they don't make it to the State House. But he was bold and decided to, you know, just target the State House and not being an MP. The young people, they really like him. And when he speaks during rallies, he would want everybody to come closer and listen to him. And he would tell them how much the BDP, you know, has made them suffer. And, you know, he even told the, President Masisi during the last debate, my friend, you know, you have tried, but your party just can't do it anymore. And, you know, people fell in love with him even more. And this is the result.
Do they believe the promises that he made, though, I'm wondering?
Well, I think it's more than just about his promises. It's also about the ones that were made by the BDP and Masisi, and to say, but politicians do make these promises. But maybe for now, let's change. Let's try somebody different. Because I can tell you that most people who voted for the UDC are not really members of the UDC or parties under the UDC, because the BNF is the bigger party in the UDC, but they don't have such many members in their databases. The AP is relatively a small party. They can't, you know, do much. Even the BPP is also a very small party. They can't do much on their own. So certainly this was Botswana, even BDP members saying, no, let's just try someone new.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's the journalist Innocent Silahlwa in Gaborone. To Kenya now, where it has become common to hear, mostly via social media, that a critic of President William Ruto's government has gone missing. Victims of this have described being picked up by unidentified people, mostly men in hoods and in unmarked vehicles. Some of them turn up in police stations after public outcry. Some of them turn up dead. Others are never found. Human rights groups are accusing the government of sanctioning these abductions, especially following the June anti-government protests where dozens of people died. Prominent human rights activist Boniface Mwangi is among those on the receiving end of these actions. Just recently, he was picked up from his home at dawn and held for several hours before police said they were holding him at a city police station. He was released a day later. No charges were brought against him. And he's been telling me about his latest experience at the hands of armed, masked men. It's not the first time it has happened to you, right?
Yes, it's happened a couple of times.
Do you almost come to expect it now?
No, actually, because everything I do is within the law. So I thought, you know what, why are you arresting me? The problem, the terms have changed because now you get picked and you can disappear forever. And that's a big problem. Or you get picked and then you end up dead in a quarry or a river, dumped in a river, or you're never found. So we're living in very dark, dangerous times where you don't know if you're going to get abducted. So not only am I concerned, my family is concerned, my friends are concerned. And that's why there was a big uproar when I got picked up, because Kenyans didn't know if I was going to reappear anywhere. The people who came to arrest me did not wear a uniform, and the law says you should be identifiable in your uniform. They did not introduce themselves. They tracked me using my cell phone, which is also illegal. They didn't have a warrant to do that. They did an illegal search. Everything around my arrest was clandestine.
When was the first time you were picked up?
So this year, I've been arrested 4 times, I think. There's no year or time that passes without me getting arrested. But every time I get arrested, when they manage to get some fabricated charges in court, I get acquitted because I'm not a lawbreaker at all. From 2009, I'm routinely arrested. Every other time I'm trying to organize, I go to a protest, they pick me up. I say something, they pick me from my house. That has been the nature of the work I do.
So for the last 15 years, you've been talking about being picked up or being arrested or being abducted. Is there a difference between those things?
Yes. So getting arrested is where the police will pick you up. Like in a protest, they can say you've done something wrong and they arrest you, which is, there's nothing wrong about that. But the difference this year actually has been, I could be walking down the street, you know, in St. Way, then they tried to abduct me. I was at a city mortuary where there were people who had been killed during the protest. And I was sitting outside, 3 cars came, parked outside to abduct me. And then I've been trying to be followed. So abduction means they tend to get a window where they can go away with you. And if they do that, and no one sees, you can disappear forever.
Has it become more dangerous, more scary, more deadly for people like you to be seen as an opponent of the state, of the government in Kenya over the last 15 years for you?
Yeah, it is, yeah. So you get profiled and you get attacked a lot. There's a narrative that the government says that you're Western puppets, you're funded by the West. It's like talking about the rule of law, or human rights or democracy is a foreign concept. It's more dangerous this year.
So what would you describe what happened to you on Sunday as, an arrest or an abduction?
It was an abduction, an attempted disappearance. You know, like they do what we refer to as enforced disappearance, where they arrest you and disappear forever. That was the attempt to do that, but they did not succeed.
So what happened? So
this is actually what happened. My phone was off the entire night. I put on my phone, and 2 minutes later, my phone rings, and I picked and I spoke to someone. And actually, when I was talking to someone, there was a knock on my door. So my nephew was in the house, and there was someone at the door who had knocked. And then when he went to open the door, there was only one person, and 6 people jumped in the room. So he called me and said, some people are here for you. So I hid my phone. I went to the sitting room. I found police officers. They said, I didn't know they actually were police, but they said, no, you're here. And so I told them, okay, you're here to arrest me. Can I use the bathroom? So I went to use the bathroom. I went to the bathroom and I locked the door and I was going to call my son and say, get me a jumper, because, you know, very well, in the arrest, they don't give you anything. So I need to get a sweater because it's very cold where they put you every time they arrest you. So I told my son I'm being arrested and you tell your mother that I'm being picked. And what the mother did, she went on social media and told everyone that I'm being picked.
So when they took you, you went to a police station. How did they treat you? How long did you stay in detention?
So I get picked up. They were all armed and in civilian clothes. I get into the car. So I had 2 officers with AK-47 on both sides of the seat. There's a guy in front who had a gun as well. The driver had a gun. And then there were 2 cars. So they waited for a phone call to know where to take me. They took me to a place called Nairobi area. I was taken to another room and handed over to other officers. And then they kept me there for a while, maybe like 30 minutes. Then they got another phone call, took me to a place called Kampunji police station. This is one of the most dirtiest, stinkiest police station. You have street boys, muggers, snatchers, all manner of criminals are in there. And so it's a degrading place.
So who was on the other end of the phone, do you think? And what do you think was going on with them sort of taking you from one place to the other? And also the attitude of the people that were arresting you. It seems like there was no personal animus on their part. They didn't rough you up. They were just come to fetch you, and then they were taking you around waiting for orders. Was that the vibe?
Very hostile.
Oh,
they were
I
very
see.
Hostile in their house.
Right.
They
okay.
were very, very hostile, and I didn't want to give them trouble. The thing is, I always resist getting arrested or being taken away. There's not a single picture of me getting arrested in a peaceful way. But this time it was different. My kids were in the room. So I walked away without raising a fight or resisting or demanding to why I've been arrested. I would have done that if my son was not there and there were no kids in the room. Could have been a different fight.
Under what circumstances were you released then?
There was no charge. So they had a charge sheet that was faulty. Incident to violence, sent to carry flags, a lot of silly charges. The file was sent to the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecution. Then he said, no, there's no charge here. So I was released.
Now, let's look at the events leading up to in the days before this latest arrest. You called on people to demonstrate at a privately organized city marathon in Nairobi, which happened on Sunday the 27th. Why did you ask Kenyans to occupy a private event?
I told Kenyans it was a very simple thing. You're going to run a marathon. Give a meaning to the run. Run for a greater cause. If you're a marathon participant, wear the Kenyan flag because it's a symbol of resistance. If you're not part of the marathon, carry a placard, display a placard. There's a race in Ireland, people being given out Palestinian flags. So any place that you're in, you can occupy between June, July, August. You occupy churches, you occupy clubs. We've been saying Ruto must go in every place that we get. Everything we're asking people, saying people, don't just be a participant in a marathon. Be an active citizen. Give a meaning to your run. Don't just run like a headless chicken. So there's nothing wrong with that.
So do you think that the two events are linked?
They are my arrest and that, yes, that's the reason I was arrested. They even said as much.
So when President Ruto came into power, he said that the government would ensure that these things don't happen again. Because let's face it, Kenya is quite notorious for these abductions and, you know, extrajudicial killings through various bodies, paralegal or paramilitary structures. So what I'm wondering is, why do you think this is happening? Does it feel like it's on the rise, or do you feel like it's sort of simmering under control and it can easily be unleashed, these abductions and forceful reactions to protests?
It's on the rise, and it's a very sad thing because Kenya was like that in the 80s. So we're going back to the same era. There's a plan to change the constitution to extend term limits from 5 years to 7 years, and people are trying to organize around that. So the reason why we're occupying private events and private things is we're trying to tell people any organized crowd is a place to do civic education and organize around these issues, because at the moment you can't call for a peaceful protest. They're not allowed. And if you call for a peaceful protest, you get arrested, people get tear gassed, people get shot at. It's just bad, bad, bad.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's the activist Boniface Mwangi in Nairobi. We put these allegations to the government of Kenya. The spokesperson Isaac Mwaura responded.
Would like to reiterate, just like the Director of Criminal Investigations has said before, the government is not in any way involved in the killing or abduction of anybody, because there's been such a narrative, but it's just propaganda. It's fake news. We believe that people are free to express themselves in a democratic way, and everyone has the right to do that.
That's Isaac Mwaura, who speaks for the Kenyan government. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Southeastern Nigeria is a troubled patch, and it has been that way since the 60s. A separatist movement arose following two coup attempts that were blamed on the Igbo people of the southeast. Here's a quick look back at what happened then and brought us to our story today.
In 1960, Britain, the colonial power, granted independence to Nigeria, a diverse country with hundreds of ethnic groups. By the time, Nigeria was dominated by the Hausa people in the northern region, the Yorubas in the western region, and the Igbos in the eastern region. But it wasn't too long before this new nation, Nigeria, was plunged into political and ethnic turmoil. This involved two military takeovers in 1966. And soon, these tensions led to the killings of thousands of minority Igbos living in northern Nigeria. So in the southeast, a military officer named Emeka Ojukwu declared the independence of the Republic of Biafra on behalf of the Igbo people. But Nigeria would not accept this. And on the 6th of July 1967, civil war broke out, and it raged on for the next 2.5 years. It's estimated that more than 1 million people died, most of them from hunger. In 1968, images of the famine were streamed worldwide. Biafran leaders used these pictures to gain sympathy for their cause. Back on the battlefield, the Nigerians were stronger and better equipped. And in January 1970, the Biafran secessionists surrendered. But a new generation of pro-Biafra separatists have reignited the cause. Arguably, the most prominent group is the Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB. The British Nigeria founder, Nnamdi Kanu, was arrested for his rhetoric in 2015, but he fled Nigeria in 2017 while out on bail. He was extradited back to the country and continues to be detained.
I've said before, and allow me to repeat, Biafra or death. One of the two must happen.
That's the voice of the Indigenous People of Biafra leader, Nnamdi Kanu. Today, the organization is challenging a government ban on it on the basis that it is a terrorist organization. A high court had nullified the proscription, saying it was unconstitutional. The government challenged that ruling. Now, the Court of Appeal has decided to delay its final decision on whether or not the government was right to label IPOB a terrorist organization. This delay is raising tensions in the southeast, where many people support the organization. I've been speaking to Dr. Michael Ugweze, a lecturer in political science at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka.
IPOB came into existence sometimes around 2012. Before that time, the entire struggle about Biafra in East Resistance Plan that started in 1999 was championed by myself, that's Movement for the Actualization of the Sovereign State of Biafra. And then Mazi Nnamdi Kanu was in charge of his radio wing, the Radio Biafra. But after the incarceration and release of the then leader of MASOV, Chief Raf Uwazurike, and then the fear within the Biafra leadership hierarchy that Uwazurike had compromised the struggle, it led to factionalization of MASOV. And from that factionalization came IPOB, the Indigenous People of Biafra, now led by Nnamdi Kanu.
And IPOB and its leadership are fighting the classification of themselves as a terrorist organization. But what led to this tension, this friction, this separatist impulse in that part of Nigeria?
In summary, I can say is the nature of Nigerian government approach towards resolving its security problems. Essentially, the struggle for Biafra was a peaceful movement which was clamped down by the government using brute force. But from 2012, when IPOB emerged, it began to champion a different strategy of nonviolent confrontation, centering on the need for the Nigerian government to convoke a referendum for the people of the southeast and some other parts of the south-south that belong to the hitherto Biafra, for them to convoke a referendum for them to choose whether or not to belong to the Republic of Nigeria or to form a Biafra Republic. And then this did not go down well with the Nigerian government. The agitation, just like previous ones before IPOB, well, never went down well with the Nigerian government. However, the government of President Goodluck Jonathan that was in power when IPOB emerged did not follow through with the kind of brute force witnessed before. It was after Goodluck Jonathan's administration that the whole of Biafra struggle led by IPOB was hyped. And then the hyping of the Biafra struggle also brought the discourse into international foray. And it was then that the leader, Mazi Nnamdi Kanu, was placed on watch list by the government and was eventually arrested in 2015 and then incarcerated. And then in 2017, the court ruled on his bail application and then granted him bail. After granting him bail, the bail conditions were so stringent, such that he was prevented from having meetings with more than five persons, and that was a bail. So when he returned after that release, the Nigerian government activated its Operation Python Dance 2. And through the Operation Python Dance 2, military personnel were deployed to the southeast. Many of them moved straight to Abia, and then violent confrontation erupted between the military and the group who were protesting. And from the protest, Nnamdi Kanu's house was raided. Many people were killed. In fact, in the Amnesty International report, there was evidence of some being infused with chemicals. People who were killed and then dissolved with chemicals, as found in that report. And it was at that time that Nnamdi Kanu escaped from military brutality. And then the actions that followed then led the federal government of Nigeria to declare IPOB a terrorist organization.
Why is the Nigerian government so determined not to entertain discussion or to demonstrate this kind of strength against the idea of an independent state in southeastern Nigeria?
Issues relating to the Igbos in Nigeria and then Biafra in general evokes fear. And that fear is that Nigeria continues to hang on this constitution, that there is no room for any separation. But that of Biafra is very important to them, one, because, you know, the earlier Biafra struggle and Biafra independence that was declared sometime around 1967 included the regions that supplied Nigeria's crude oil, the Niger Delta, some parts of the Niger Delta areas. And then, even though the current struggle is being championed by actors majorly from the southeast, there is still that fear that if there is any need to sit for discussion and give room for people to choose whether to belong to Nigeria or to form a separate Biafra Republic, the fear is that people will settle for Biafra Republic. Therefore, there should not be any reason and opportunity where such discussion should be raised.
So tell me this then. Why is there such an impulse in the southeast of Nigeria to separate from the rest of the country?
It has been a historical matter. There has been mistrust in Nigeria. And for the Igbos, you know, the coup of 15th January 1966 was labeled an Igbo coup, even though history has shown in all ramifications, including those that participated in the coup, that this was never really an Igbo coup. And then that coup, which killed some notable northern politicians, left a scar in the body of the northern leaders and the masses generally, which also followed pogrom against the Igbos. So in order to protect themselves, since the federal military government then could not protect them, they chose to now form their own republic, especially at the collapse of the Abure Accord, still engineered by the government of Yakubu Gowon. Many years after that war, all the feelings, the trauma, the mistrust that accompanied the war has continued to persist, giving rise to a feeling of marginalization. And this marginalization has been taken to a level that makes some majority citizens of the southeast to feel no more sense of belonging in the system and then more like second-class citizens in their own country. Instead of living in such situation, why not allow us to form our own country so that we can live as a people and independent people? That's the feeling in the southeast, and that's the statement that resonates among the masses from the region.
So does IPOB have mass support in southeastern Nigeria?
IPOB has very massive support in southeastern Nigeria. Even though some persons may not be physically joining them in their approach or may not agree with some of their strategies, but there is a common ground among all the people or majority of the people about that feeling of alienation that makes them subscribe to the IPOB movement.
Will there ever be an independent republic? Will the government of Nigeria ever agree to that?
I don't think anybody, and that includes the Igbos, I don't think they are so eager bigger about having a different country if Nigeria works for everybody, if there is sense of belonging in Nigeria. But because there is this lack of sense of belonging, there is this visible marginalization of the people, they are now agitating for a separate country. It's not going to be easy. And given the nature of Nigerian system, it cannot be guaranteed that government will ever allow Biafra to go in peace.
Do you think that IPOB will win this challenge of their status as a terrorist organization in court?
It's about winning their case in court in terms of whether they are a terrorist organization or not. Pillars is that people are optimistic they will win. But in terms of winning a country and having Biafra, that's where the difficulty remains.
That's Dr. Michael Ugweze, a lecturer in political science at the University of Nigeria, Nsukka. And that's almost it for this edition of the podcast. But you can now also find us on YouTube. Just search for us by name, Focus on Africa Podcast. You'll also be able to catch up on our past episodes. And if you'd like to get in touch, send us an email to focusonafrica@bbc.co.uk. Today's edition of Focus on Africa comprises the creative and journalistic endeavors of Nyasha Michelle and Yvette Twagira Maria here in London. Charles Kitonga made his contribution from Nairobi. Blessing Aderogba brought it from Lagos. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist in charge. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for your company.